It was another hour before the new arrangement could be put into effect, and once more the column headed south and west into the great empty land, with its distant smoky horizons and its vast vaulted blue dome of the burning heavens. Count Aldo Belli rode easier on the luxurious leather of the Rolls, cheered by the knowledge that preceding him were 345 fine rubbery sets of peasant testicles upon which the barbarian could blunt his blade. The column went into bivouac that evening, 53 kilometres from Asmara. Not even the count could pretend that this was a forced march for motorised infantry, but the advantage was that a pair of motorcyclists could be sent back with a dispatch for General de Bono, reassuring him of the patriotism, the loyalty, and the fighting ardour of the 3rd Battalion. And, of course, on their return, the cyclists could carry blocks of ice from the casino, packed in salt and straw, and stowed in the sidecars. The following morning, the Count had recovered much of his good cheer. He rose early, at 9 o'clock, and took a hearty al fresco breakfast with his officers under the shade of a spread tarpaulin. Then, from the rear seat of the Rolls, he gave the clenched fist cavalry order to advance. Still in the centre of the column, pennants fluttering and battle standard glittering, the Rolls glided forward, and it looked, even to the disillusioned major, as if they might make good going of the day's march. The undulating grassland fell away almost imperceptibly beneath the speeding wheels, and the blue loom of the mountains on their right hand merged gradually with the lighter, fiercer blue of the sky. The transition to desert country was so gradual as to lull the unobservant traveller. The intervals between the flat-topped acacia trees became greater, and the trees themselves were more stunted, more twisted and spiky as they progressed, until at last they ceased, and the bushes of Spina Christi replaced them, grey and low and viciously thorned. The earth was parched and crumbled, dotted with clumps of camel grass, and the horizon was unbroken, enclosing them entirely. The land itself was so flat and featureless that it gave the illusion of being saucer-shaped, as though the rim of the land rose slightly to meet the sky. Through this wilderness the road was slashed like the claw mark of a predator into the fleshy red soil. The tracks were so deeply rutted that the middle hump constantly brushed the chassis of the Rolls, and a mist of fine red dust stood in the heated air long after the column had passed. The colonel was bored and uncomfortable. It was becoming increasingly clear, even to the count, that the wilderness harboured no hostile horde, and his courage and impatience returned. "Drive it to the head of the column," he instructed Giuseppe. And the Rolls pulled out and sped past the leading trucks, the count bestowing a cheery salute on Castellani as he left him glowering and muttering behind him. When Castellani caught up with him again 2 hours later, the count was standing on the burnished bonnet of the Rolls, staring through his binoculars at the horizon and doing an excited little dance, while he urged Gino to make haste in unpacking the special Mannlicher 9.3mm sporting rifle from its leather case. The weapon was of seasoned walnut, butt and stock, and the blued steel was inlaid with 24-carat gold hunting scenes of the chase, boar and stag, huntsmen on horseback and hounds in full cry. It was a masterpiece of the gunsmith's art. With lowering the binoculars, he gave orders to Castellani to erect the radio aerial and send a message of good cheer and enthusiasm to General de Bono, to report the magnificent progress made by the battalion to date, and assure him that they would soon command all the approaches to the Sardi Gorge. The major should also put the column into lager and set up the ice machine, while the colonel undertook a reconnaissance patrol in the direction in which he was now staring so intently. The group of big dun-coloured animals he was watching were a mile off and moving steadily away into the mirage-fevered distance, but their gracefully straight horns showed dark and long against the distant sky. Gino had the loaded Mannlicher in the rear seat, and the Count jumped down into the passenger seat beside the driver. Standing, holding the windshield with one hand, he gave his officers the fascist salute, and the Rolls roared forward, left the road, and careered away, weaving amongst the thorn scrub and bounding over the rough ground in pursuit of the distant herd. The Baser Oryx is a large and beautiful desert antelope. There were eight of them in the herd, and with their sharp eyesight, they were in flight before the Rolls had approached, within 3/4 of a mile. They ran lightly over the rough ground, their pale beige hides blending cunningly with the soft colours of the desert. But the long, wicked black horns rode proudly as any battle standard. The Rolls gained steadily on the running herd, with the Count hysterically urging his driver to greater speed, ignoring the thorn branches that scored the flawless sides of the big blue machine as it passed. Hunting was one of the Count's many pleasures. Boar and stag were specially bred on his estates, but this was the first large game he'd encountered since his arrival in Africa. The herd was strung out, two old bulls leading, plunging ahead with a light rocking horse gait, while the cows and two younger males trailed them. The bouncing, roaring machine drew level with the last animal and ran alongside at a range of 20 yards. The galloping oryx did not turn its head but ran on doggedly after its stronger companions. "Halt!" shrieked the Count, and the driver stood on his brakes, the car broadsiding to rest in a billowing cloud of dust. The Count tumbled out of the open door and threw up the mannlicher. The barrel kicked up and the shots crashed out. The first was a touch high, and it threw a puff of dust off the earth, far beyond the running animal. The second slapped into the pale fur in front of the shoulder, and the young oryx somersaulted over its broken neck and went down in a clumsy tangle of limbs. "Onwards!" shouted the Count, leaping aboard the Rolls as it roared away once again. The herd was already far ahead, but inexorably the Rolls closed the gap and at last drew level. Again the ringing crack of rifle fire and the sliding, tumbling fall of a heavy, pale body. Like a paper chase, they left the wasteland littered with the pale bodies until only one old bull ran on alone. And he was cunning, swinging away westward into the broken ground for which he had clearly headed at the outset of the chase. It was hours and many miles later when the Count lost all patience. On the lip of another wadi, he stopped the Rolls and ordered Gino, protesting volubly, to stand at attention and offer his shoulder as a dead rest for the mannlicher. The Baser had slowed now to an exhausted trot, but the range was 600 yards as the Count sighted across the intervening scrub and through heat-dancing air that swirled like gelatinous liquid. The rifle fire cracked the desert silences, and the antelope kept trotting steadily away, while the Count shrieked abuse at it and crammed a fresh load of brass cartridges into the magazine. The animal was almost beyond effective range now, but the next bullet fired, with a rear sight at maximum elevation, fell in a long, arching trajectory, and they heard the thump of the strike, long after the Baser had collapsed abruptly and disappeared below the line of grey scrub. When they'd found another crossing and forced the Rolls through the deep ravine, scraping the rear fender and denting one of the big silver wheel hubs, they came up to the spot where the antelope lay on its side. Leaving the rifle on the back seat in his eagerness, the Count leapt out before the Rolls had stopped completely. "Get one of me completing the coup de grace," he shouted at Gino, as he unholstered the ivory-handled Beretta and ran to the downed animal. The soft bullet had shattered the spinal column a few inches forward of the pelvis, paralyzing the hind quarters, and the blood pumped gently from the wound in a bright rivulet down the pale beige flank. The Count posed dramatically, pointing the pistol at the magnificently horned head with its elaborate face mask of dark chocolate stripes. Nearby, Gino knelt in the soft earth, focusing the camera. At the critical moment, the antelope heaved itself up into a sitting position and stared with swimming, agonized eyes into the Count's face. The pacer is one of the most aggressive antelopes in Africa, capable of killing even a fully grown lion with its long rapier horns. This old bull weighed 450 pounds and stood 4 feet high at the shoulder, while the horns rose another 3 feet above that. The baser snorted, and the Count forgot all about the leveled pistol in his hand in his sudden, desperate desire to reach the safety of the rolls. Leading the baser by 6 inches, he vaulted lightly into the back seat and crouched on the floorboards, covering his head with both arms, while the baser battered the sides of the rolls, driving in one door and ripping the paintwork with the deadly horns. Gino was trying to disappear into the earth by sheer pressure, and he was making a pitiful wailing sound. The driver had stalled the engine, and he sat frozen in his seat, and every time the baser crashed into the rolls, he was thrown so violently forward that his forehead struck the windshield, and he pleaded, "Shoot it, my Count! Please, my Count! Shoot the monster!" The Count's posterior was pointed to the sky. It was the only part of his anatomy that was visible above the rear seat of the rolls, and he was shrieking for somebody to hand him the rifle, but not raising his head to search for it. The bullet that had severed the baser's spine had angled forward and pierced the lung as well. The violent exertions of the stricken animal tore open a large artery, and with a pitiful bellow and a sudden double spurt of blood through the nostrils, it collapsed. In the long silence that followed, the Count's pale face rose slowly above the level of the back door, and he stared fearfully at the carcass. Its stillness reassured him. Cautiously, he groped for the Mannlicher, lifted it slowly, and poured a stream of bullets into the inert baser. His hands were shaking so violently that some of the shots missed the body and came perilously close to where Gino still lay, producing a fresh outburst of wails and more mole-like efforts to become subterranean. Satisfied that the baser was at last dead, the Count descended and walked slowly towards a nearby clump of thorn scrub, but his gait was bow-legged and stiff, for he had lightly soiled his magnificently monogrammed silk underwear. In the cool of the evening, the slightly crumpled rolls returned to the battalion bivouac. Draped over the bonnet and across the wide mud guards lay the bleeding carcasses of the antelopes. The Count stood to acknowledge the cheers of his troops, a veritable triumphant Nimrod. A radio message from General De Bono awaited him. It was not a reprimand. The general would not go that far, but it pointed out that although the general was grateful for the Count's efforts up to the present time, and for his fine sentiments and loyal messages, nevertheless, the general would be very grateful if the Count could find some way in which to speed up his advance. The Count sent him a 500-word reply, ending, "Ours is the victory," and then went to feast on barbecued antelope livers and iced Chianti with his officers. Leaving the sailing and handling of the Hirondelle to his Mohammedan mate and his raggedy crew, Captain Papadopoulos had spent the preceding 5 days sitting at the table in his low-roofed poop cabin, playing two-handed gin rummy with Major Gareth Swales. Gareth had suggested the diversion, and it had occurred to the captain by this time that there was something unnatural in the consistent run of winning cards which had distinguished Gareth's play. The agreed fare for transporting the cars and the four passengers had totaled 250 of sterling. The captain's losses had just exceeded that figure, and Gareth smiled winningly at Papadopoulos and smoothed the golden moustaches. "What do you say we give it a break now, Papa, old sport? Go up on deck, stretch the legs, what?" Having recovered the passage money, Gareth had accomplished the task he'd set himself, and he was now anxious to return to the open deck, where Vicky Camberwell and Jake were becoming much too friendly for his peace of mind. Every time Gareth had been forced by nature to make a brief journey to the poop rail, he'd seen the two of them together, and they seemed to be laughing a great deal, which was always a bad sign. Vicky was in the forefront of any action, passing tools to Jake and offering general encouragement, as he worked at fine-tuning the cars and making last-minute preparations for the desert crossing. Or the two of them sat with Gregorius, while amidst great hilarity he gave them basic lessons in the Amharic language. He wondered distractedly what else they were up to. However, Gareth was a man sure of his priorities, and his first concern was to recover his money from Papadopoulos. Having done so, he could now return to sheepdogging Vicky Camberwell. "It's been a lot of fun, Papa." He half rose from the table, folding the grimy wad of banknotes into his back pocket and gathering the pile of coins with his free hand. Captain Papadopoulos reached into the depth of the Arabic gown he wore and produced a knife with an ornately carved handle and a viciously curved blade. He balanced it lightly in the palm of his hand, and his single eye glittered coldly at Gareth. "Deal," he said. And Gareth smiled blandly and sank back into his seat. He picked up the cards and cut them with a ripping sound, and the knife disappeared into Papadopoulos's gown once more as he watched the shuffle intently. "Actually, I do feel like a few more hands," Gareth murmured. "Just getting warmed up, eh?" The slaver altered course as she cleared the tip of the Great Horn of Africa and rounded Cape Guardafui. Before her lay the long gut of the Gulf of Aden and a run of 500 miles westwards to French Somaliland. The Hindu mate came down and whispered fearfully to his captain. "What troubles the fellow?" Gareth asked. "He worries about the English blockade."
"So do I," Gareth answered.
"Shouldn't we go up on deck?"
"Deal,"
said Papadopoulos. Below them they heard the steady thumping beat of the big diesel engine begin and the vibration of the propeller shaft spinning in its bed. The mate had her under sail and power now, and the motion of the ship changed immediately, the thrust of the propeller combining with the push of the full spread of her canvas, and she flew towards the vivid purple and pink flush of sky and piled cumulus cloud behind which the sun was beginning to set. The mate had set a course which would take him swiftly down the middle of the gulf, out of sight of Africa on his port side and Arabia on the starboard. The Hirondelle was making 25 knots, for the sea breeze was on her best point of sailing, and a day and two nights would see them in and out again. He sent one of his best men to the masthead with a telescope, and he wondered which the English viewed more sternly, young black girls in chains or Vickers machine guns in wooden cases. Mournfully, he concluded that either of them would be lethal, and he shrilled at his masthead to keep a strict watch. The sun was sinking with agonizing slowness, almost dead ahead, and the wind rose steadily, driving the Hirondelle on deeper into the gut. Jake Barton wriggled out of the engine hatch of Miss Wobbly and grinned at Vicky Camberwell, who sat on the sponson above him, swinging her long legs idly, and the wind in her hair and the tan she'd picked up in the last few days, gilding her arms and flushing at her cheeks. She'd lost the dark rings of worry and the paleness of fatigue, and looked now like a schoolgirl, young and carefree and gay.
"That's the best I can do," said Jake, beginning to scour the black grease from his arms with scrub's ammonia. "She's running so sweetly, I could take her out of Le Mans."
Her knees were at the level of Jake's eyes, and her skirts had rucked up high. He felt his heart stop as he glanced down the smooth length of her thigh. Her skin had a luster and sheen, as though made of some precious and rare substance. Vicky saw the direction of his gaze and brought her knees together sharply, although a smile touched her lips. She jumped down lightly onto the deck, steadying herself against the Hirondelle's rolling action with a touch on the muscled hardness of his arm. Vicky thoroughly enjoyed the admiration of an attractive male, and Gareth had been closeted in the captain's cabin these last 5 days. She smiled up at Jake. He was tall, but the bush of dark hair that curled around his ears gave him the look of a small boy, which was again quickly dispelled by the strong jawline and the fine networks of creases that radiated from the outer corners of his eye.
She realized suddenly that he was on the point of stooping to kiss her, and she felt a delicious indecision. The slightest encouragement would set Jake on a violent collision course with Gareth and might seriously endanger the whole expedition and the story she wanted so badly. At that moment, she noticed, as if for the first time, that Jake's mouth was wide and full, and his lips were delicately shaped for the bigness and hairiness of him. His chin and cheeks were blued with a day's growth of beard, and she knew it would feel rough and electric against her own peach-smooth cheeks. Suddenly she wanted to feel that, and she lifted her chin slightly and knew that he would read that want in the sparkle of her eyes. The masthead shrieked like a startled gull, and instantly the Hirondelle was plunged into frantic activity. The Mohammedan mate echoed his shrieks, but at a higher volume, and his grubby robes flapped around him in the wind. His eyes rolled in his dark brown skull, and his toothless maw opened so wide that Jake could see the little pink glottis dangling in the back of his throat. "What is it?" Vicky demanded, her hand still on Jake's arm. "Trouble," he answered grimly. And they turned as the door of the poop cabin flew open, and Papadopoulos rushed out, with his queue twitching like the tail of a lioness, and his single eye blinking rapidly. He still clutched a fan of cards in his right hand. "One more card and I make a gin," he howled bitterly, and threw the cards into the wind, and grabbed the mate by the front of his gown, shouting into his open but now silent mouth. The mate pointed aloft, and Papadopoulos dropped him and hailed the masthead in Arabic, and Jake listened to the swift exchange. "A British destroyer. Sounds like Dauntless," he muttered. "You speak Arabic?" Vicky asked, and Jake stilled the question irritably and listened again. "The destroyer's seen us. She's altering course to intercept." Jake looked quickly at the smouldering globe of the sun, the crinkles round his eyes puckering up thoughtfully, as he listened to the heated argument in Arabic taking place on the poop deck. "Are you two having fun?" Gareth Swales asked, smiling but with a glitter in his eyes, as he glanced significantly at Vicky's hand still on Jake's arm. He'd come out of the cabin as silently as a panther. Vicky dropped her hand guiltily and immediately wished she had not. She owed Gareth Swales no debts, and she answered his stare defiantly, before turning back to Jake and finding him gone. "What is it, Papa?" Gareth called up at the poop deck, and the captain snarled. "Your Royal Mucking Navy, that's what it is," and he shook his fist at the northern horizon. "The Dauntless, she based at Aden, blockade for slavers." "Where is she?" Gareth's expression changed swiftly, and he strode to the rail. "She coming fast, masthead watching her. She'll be over the horizon pretty damn quick." Papadopoulos turned from Gareth and roared a series of orders at his crew. Immediately they swarmed down onto the main deck and gathered about the first car. It was Priscilla the pig, swaying gently on her suspension as the schooner plunged ahead. "I say," Gareth exclaimed, "what are you up to?" "They catch me with arms aboard, big trouble," Papadopoulos explains. "No arms, no trouble." And he watched his men fall on the lines that secured the big white-painted vehicle. "We do same trick with slaves. They go down pretty damn fast with the chains." "Now, just hold on a shake. I paid you a fortune to transport this cargo." "What? Where that fortune now, Major?" Papadopoulos shouted down at him derisively. "I got nothing in my pants. How about you?" And the captain turned away to urge his men on. The turret of Priscilla the pig opened suddenly, and from it emerged the head and shoulders of Jake Barton, with his hair blowing in the wind, and a Vickers machine gun in his arms. He braced himself in the turret, with the thick water-jacketed barrel of the Vickers across the crook of his left arm, and the pistol grip firmly enclosed in his other hand. Across his shoulder was draped a heavy necklace of belted ammunition. He fired a roaring, chattering burst, the tracer streaking in fiery white balls of flame a mere 12 inches over the captain's head. The Greek threw himself flat on his deck, howling with terror, and his crew scattered like a flock of startled hens, while Jake looked down on them benignly from his post in the turret.
"I think we should understand each other, Captain. Nobody's going to touch these machines. The only way you're going to save your ship is by outsailing the Englishman," Jake called mildly.
"She can make 30 knots,
protested the captain, still face down on the deck.
"Longer you talk, less time you have," Jake told him. "It'll be dark in 20 minutes. Turn away and make a stern chase of it till it's dark."
Papadopoulos rose uncertainly to his feet and stood, blinking his one eye rapidly and miserably wringing his hands.
"Kindly move your arse," said Jake affably,
and fired another burst of machine-gun bullets over his head. The captain dropped once again to the deck, howling the orders to bring the Hirondelle around onto a course directly away from the closing British warship. As the schooner came around onto her new course, Jake called Gareth across to him and handed him the machine gun.
"I want this bunch of bastards covered while I work with the Greek. You, Vicky, and Greg can batten down the hatches on the cars in the meantime."
"Where did you get that gun?" Gareth asked. "I thought they were all cased."
"I like to keep a little insurance at all times," Jake grinned.
Gareth selected 2 cheroots from his case, lit them both, and passed one up to Jake.
"Compliments of the management," he said.
"I'm beginning to know why I picked you as a partner." Jake stuck the cheroot in the side of his mouth, exhaled a long blue feather of smoke, and grinned jauntily.
"If you've got any pull with your Royal Navy, lad, then get ready to use it."
Jake stood in the deep canvas crow's nest at the crosstrees of the main mast and swayed with a gut-swooping rhythm through the arc of the swinging mast as he tried to keep the grey silhouette that closed them rapidly in the field of the telescope.